All right, welcome back to the Fitz News Studios for another edition of Your Week in Review. This is our first week back after last week's Month in Review. Very excited to launch the second installment of that segment later this month. But for now, we're recapping several big stories that we covered over the past week. At the top of that list, the looming retrial of Michael Colucci. This is a story that 6 years ago, a mistrial and a highly watched murder case. We're going to walk you through all the details of this incredible saga and whether or not we believe the state can secure a conviction the second time around. We're also going to walk you through another mystery unfolding on the banks of the Coosahatchee River down there on the border of Hampton and Jasper counties in the South Carolina Lowcountry. Our Andy Fancher is going to tell you what law enforcement discovered at a boat landing on the banks of that river and where that narrative is taking us. We don't know as we go to film this episode, but we're going to fill you in on the very latest on that mystery on the banks of the Coosahatchee. Last but not least, I'm going to sit down with Dylan Nolan, our special projects director, who has turned into a State House reporter extraordinaire following multiple key bills and key political races flowing out of those legislative debates. We're going to walk you through the judicial reform debate, the debate over liability in the Palmetto State, and a contentious state Senate race that has got the Palmetto political season off to a sizzling start. All that and more heading your way on the Week in Review. So as I mentioned at the outset, the Office of South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson is preparing for a major retrial in the case of Michael Colucci. This is a jeweler from Somerville, South Carolina, accused of murdering his 38-year-old wife, strangling her, and then posing her as though she had committed suicide using a garden hose. The case attracted national headlines when it went to trial the first time back in 2018. That trial ended with a mistrial. I'm joined by Jen Wood. You've been researching this story. Obviously, our Cali Lions posted an initial treatment of the retrial saga just this week. Jen, based on what you've seen, is the state going to fare any better the second go-round as it seeks to stick the murder rap to Michael Colucci?
Well, there's a reason the Colucci trial garnered national attention the first time around, and I expect it to do the same thing. And we're looking at, much like the Murdaugh crime and corruption saga, we are looking at a case in which the evidence against the defendant, Michael Colucci, is largely circumstantial. And I think that played a big role in the jury's inability to reach a decision in the first trial, which led to a mistrial. So it is definitely going to be interesting to see if they've come up with new evidence or if they're just presenting the same evidence from before to a different jury.
Well, and to be clear, the last time, Jen, the jury wasn't even considering a murder verdict. They were considering voluntary manslaughter or whether to let him go. This wasn't a case that the state appeared to have proven the murder rap at all.
Correct. Correct. And, you know, the circumstances surrounding the day that Sarah Colucci died, it's almost unbelievable, you know, that they had visited her late husband's grave. He had died years before by suicide, and went out to dinner. And on the way home, she said she, according to Michael Colucci, had to use the restroom. So he pulled off at their Somerville jewelry store, and she proceeded around the back of the building to go in and use the bathroom on the way home. And after some time, he got worried. This is according to Michael Colucci, went to find her and found her hanging from a garden hose from the fence surrounding the building. So, yeah, I mean, just very bizarre circumstances. The defense argues that Sarah Colucci was dealing with depression, largely due to the death of her ex-husband, and that the Colucci's, Michael and Sarah, were having a great deal of financial issues. Their water had been turned off, and, you know, there was a lot of stressors in their life.
And of course, there are allegations of drug use, and we can't omit the fact that the tox report on Sarah Colucci came back positive for cocaine, for Xanax. She also had a very elevated blood alcohol content, nearly three times the legal limit. Obviously not implying anything other than to say that's what was found in the autopsy. But Jen, let me ask you this. Michael Colucci has told a lot of different stories about what happened after they arrived at this jewelry store that they owned in Somerville. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, talking specifically about where he was and where she was, i.e. where he was in the car when she went to go to the bathroom ostensibly, but then where her body was found. We're talking 20 feet away, Jen, a direct line of sight. How does this guy not how does he not see what's going on?
Right. I mean, it's completely unbelievable. How does he not see what's going on? I think it took him some amount of time to even get up and look for her and then realize that, according to him, she was hanging and call 911. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, why'd she go around to the back door? You know, and there was stuff that came up in the first trial that I think it's going to be interesting to see how they present it the second time around. For example, SLED agent David Owen, who a lot of people remember from the Murdoch trial, testified that Sarah Colucci had a tendency to just pee outside when she had to go to the bathroom. So why did she feel the need to walk around the side of the building and use a restroom at this point? So there's a lot of interesting factors to this case. And I don't believe that the SLED investigation, that they did a very thorough job collecting DNA and forensic evidence from the scene, because they were called in later. You know, when SLED went out to investigate, it was 11 months after Sarah had died.
Right. It was initially a Berkeley County Sheriff's Office investigation. Jen, let me ask you about this. You raised the issue of David Owen, and obviously when you look at that probable cause affidavit that was issued for the arrest of Michael Colucci in May of 2016, a year after the murder, David Owen's name is obviously on there. And David Owen, in a retrial, is going to be a much more difficult witness for the prosecution than he would have been the first time, because obviously we now have these allegations that were raised in the Murdoch trial about not being truthful to the grand jury regarding some of those Murdoch indictments. Jen, walk us through the potential impact of the Murdoch aspect of David Owen and how that could impact the Colucci trial.
Yeah, so during the Murdoch trial, you know, while the prosecution was presenting their case, we kept hearing David Owen is going to be the witness to watch. Special Agent David Owen, he, you know, was the key investigator in this case. And when he took the stand on cross-examination by Jim Griffin, a lot of things were brought up regarding, you know, the DNA evidence or lack thereof that was on the clothing that they sent out for testing. So when they presented the evidence to the Gallatin County grand jury initially, David Owen said that, you know, he did not have the second report, which said there was not spatter from Maggie and Paul on Alex's shirt and shorts. And Jim Griffin countered back, "You lied to the grand jury. You lied to them about the DNA evidence on his clothing. You lied to them about, you know, how the weapons were loaded with alternating, you know, buckshot and, you know, turkey shot. Yeah, birdshot." And it was a very contentious, I think that was one of the weaker moments in the state's case as they were presenting it, was Jim Griffin's cross-examination of the lead SLED agent.
Well, let me tell you, if you think Jim Griffin is a devastating cross-examiner, Andy Savage, the attorney, lead attorney in this case, this guy is one of the best in the Palmetto State, obviously proved his mettle during the first Colucci trial. Jen, let me ask you this. Any chance that this case does not result in another black eye for David Owen and for SLED as it relates to this potential cross-examination?
I'd have to see if they did come up with any new evidence. I mean, it has been quite some time since the initial mistrial. You know, were they able to come up with any new evidence? If they're presenting the same case, it is wholly circumstantial. They don't have a lot of hard evidence. I could see this ending up in a mistrial once again.
But Colucci has obviously told some just farcical tales related to this. In fact, one of the stories he told was that his wife tripped and fell into the hose.
It And when investigator, you know, when he called 911 and first responders arrived, he had, you know, cuts on his hands and, you know, scrapes on his knees.
Had
and
a bruised lip, a puffy lip.
Bruised lip, yeah. I mean, so there are a lot of questions about his story. I think it's going to be very interesting. It, just like any criminal trial, is going to come down to jury selection.
Well, the other thing, we were talking about the autopsy of Sarah Colucci a moment ago, but one of the things that was revealed also, the grooved wounds on her neck, which I believe Colucci attempted to indicate were a result of the garden hose, they weren't from the garden hose, which is another interesting dynamic of this case. The you know, the theory that he put forward to investigators anyway, the wounds on his wife did not match that theory, Jen.
Right. So I was watching today, I was watching the cross-examination of Andy Savage of David Owen. And he was questioning, you know, how long was the garden hose? And David Owen said, I don't know, we didn't measure it. I mean, there was a lot of things that came up during the trial. It's like, how did you not measure what you claim she, you know, what she was hanging from? How did you not see how long it was? It was a very interesting cross-examination. And I did get a lot of, I felt a lot of resemblance to Jim Griffin's cross-examination during the Murdoch trial of David Owen.
Well, and again, once again, if you haven't watched Andy Savage in action, this is an attorney. And again, he's got some familiarity to our audience. Andy Savage was briefly involved in the Stephen Smith case. He took a lot of heat. One of the investigators he hired, we believe, solved the case. But again, that's been thrown in dispute by a lot of folks. But this is an attorney who has a just sterling reputation as a defense lawyer, a guy who clearly has been, in a lot of folks' minds anyway, exonerated as it relates to the Stephen Smith case, and now coming back for a second exoneration, potentially on the Colucci case. But Jen, let me ask you this. We're talking about the potential impact of the Murdoch case as it relates to David Owen and how that could cut against the state. But did the state not also prove in the Murdoch case that a circumstantial case can be won, particularly when you have a defendant like Michael Colucci, who, again, doesn't seem to be telling the truth here? One thing that we all know about the Alec Murdoch case, the man was lying.
Right.
He was lying from the very beginning. He was lying to the very end on the stand. And that is ultimately what I believe sealed his fate with the jury. If the Attorney General's office can get Michael Colucci, expose his lies, they got a chance here, Jen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, circumstantial evidence is evidence. And there are very rare occasions where a criminal case is tried with, you know, straight, hard evidence. You know, most of the time they are circumstantial. And depending on what they can prove in terms of what Michael Colucci said, what they can prove in terms of the scene that day, absolutely. Especially as questionable as her death was.
Well, this case is set to kick off a little over a month from now, mid-May in Berkeley County. Judge Jefferson, who presided over the first Colucci trial, Deidre Jefferson, she will be presiding over this retrial as well. Jen, we're going to be following it very closely. Our Andy Fancher has already been preparing some reports related to this case. Callie Lyons, obviously, on top of it, too. It's going to be a team effort here. But, Jen, thank you so much for your research on this case and letting us know exactly where you think it's headed as we begin our coverage of the Michael Colucci retrial down in Berkeley County, South Carolina. Earlier this week, Wednesday afternoon, shortly before 3 p.m., our media outlet was inundated with reports of a massive law enforcement response on the banks of the Coosahatchee River, straddling the border between Hampton and Jasper counties in the South Carolina Lowcountry. Our sources reported hearing sirens, ambulances, police cruisers, a huge response to a boat ramp located on the banks of this river. What was happening? For hours, there was no response from law enforcement, from anyone. No reports in the media, just rumors circulating on social media. But we started digging in, and I'm joined by Andy Fancher, our reporter who's been covering this story from the beginning. Andy, what happened at this boat ramp?
Well, that's a question that a lot of locals, as well as myself, continue to ask the Sheriff's Department, the Jasper County Sheriff's Office, that is a responding agency to this situation. What we do know on the record is very little. That being said, They put out a press release the following morning. So this occurred at approximately the 250 region. And the following morning, Thursday morning, they put out a press release stating that someone, they did not know the gender at the time until they got there, a female, was bound by at least the hands and found on the Corner Lake boat landing, which is a very remote, weathered slipway owned by the county, leading, of course, to the Chusawatchee River. And if we're going to rely on what Facebook has to say, we've got multiple people on there, as well as our personal sources, stating that it was a fisherman trolling out on the riverbank that found this woman. I'm pleased to report just moments ago we heard that she is conscious. She is, according to our sources yet again, still considered a Jane Doe. They have not identified this woman. And that is essentially where we are at the moment.
And this is, again, you said it's a very remote area, but this is a boat ramp that opens up into literally hundreds of acres of swampland.
Hundreds of acres. Acres addled with all kinds of wild animals that you can think of. I mean, this is a place where alligators are known to be spotted. Some people are calling it a miracle that this woman is even alive after being essentially left for dead for an indeterminate amount of time out there in such a remote corner of South Carolina. So it is a sensitive case, and it is an active investigation. The sheriff has emphasized that since the very beginning. And here we are now on Friday after just hopping off of a call with him. What did he say? That they're looking to close this case very soon.
Wow.
So what does that mean? Are we in the midst of a manhunt? Are we looking at suspect or suspects? There is a lot of unknown here. I mean, hell, we don't even know who the woman is.
Right. And a lot of the interesting thing to me about this case is so many times you see things on social media ends up being completely bunk. It was, you know, the same story told to the same 50 people and, you know, everyone's saying the same thing. And we think that's confirmation, but it's really one person just spreading it around. But right. A lot of what has been put out on Facebook, on some of the other social pages about this case, we've been able to independently confirm from sources who are familiar with the incident itself, whether we're talking about the injuries. Apparently this woman was badly beaten.
That is the general consensus, badly beaten and half naked, beyond half naked.
Wow. Unbelievable. Andy, you're on your way down to Hampton right now in Jasper County to see exactly what's going on here.
Correct. We're going to take a look at that boat landing itself. We're going to go to where it all started, potentially talk with some folks out there. But this is, of course, in preparation for what is hopefully some justice in the very near future at the time of our conversation here.
And we'll see where this case takes us.
We'll see what happens.
Good afternoon, folks. Andrew Fancher with FitzNews.com. Standing here at the Jasper County Sheriff's Office, where a press conference relating to the unidentified woman pulled from the Coosawhatchee River on Wednesday has been canceled. Instead, the Sheriff's Office issued a statement to Fitz News that reads, in part, "We will continue to work diligently in solving this case and provide each agency with an update on when we'll be able to conduct a live press release." Now this, of course, raises the question of what we know now, which according to the public, is not much. They understand that a half-naked woman was pulled from the Coosawhatchee River 2 days ago, and that she remains in a local hospital, unidentified. The JCSO has not requested the public's help in identifying this woman or her potential attacker, and instead maintains that they hope to, quote, close this case soon. So keep in tune to FitzNews.com as we provide details as they become available.
This week, the Fitz crew went to the South Carolina State House to update our audience on several pieces of legislation that we've been tracking over the last few weeks, months, and in some cases, years, particularly on the first bill. We're going to talk about the issue of judicial reform. If you follow this media outlet, you know this is something we've been passionate about, something that we have been pushing the envelope on for many years, driving the debate at the South Carolina State House, trying to get lawmakers to pay attention to it, to propose meaningful legislation. Well, this year, for the first time, they have paid attention. They have started pushing this issue, and there are certain lawmakers, chief among them, Joe White, first-term representative from Newberry County, South Carolina, who has made this his mission. And I'm joined by Dylan Nolan. Dylan, earlier this week, you went to a press conference held by Representative White outside the Richland County Courthouse, where he provided an update on the status of the judicial reform movement in the legislature. Dylan, was it a good update?
Well, if you don't like the way that South Carolina currently selects its circuit court judges, then it was certainly not a good update. This is an issue that you've been talking about for years. South Carolina is one of two states which allows the legislators to pick the judges. Obviously, this kind of runs counter to the idea of having separate and coequal branches of government, because you have one that ends up quite subservient to the other. Specifically in South Carolina, we have a 10-member panel called the JMSC who screen judicial candidates. They advance three nominees who are then voted on by the whole of the General Assembly. And this has caused some problems in the past because there have been these powerful members of the JMSC who are practicing trial attorneys who will have these judges either just, you know, had their careers basically started by these JMSC members, or who know that they're going to have to appear before the JMSC once again to have their career continue. And it creates ethical conundrums because these people have to obviously be very careful when these JMSC members are in their courtroom, or when any legislator is in their courtroom, because they have the sway of potentially impacting their career. And this is something you've addressed for a long time, but something that we didn't really expect to see change on in the General Assembly, just because it's been the status quo of how South Carolina does things for so long. But recently, a couple of high-profile cases, Bowen Turner in Orangeburg, one that our audience is certainly familiar with, Gerard Price, a convicted murderer released early with the help of JMSC member Todd Rutherford. These were cases that were blatant examples of flaws in this system, which gives too much power to the legislature. And it seemed as though the legislature might be ready to cede some of that power with House Speaker Merrill Smith impaneling a committee to put forth judicial reform legislation. But as we're approaching a couple of key days on the calendar here in the legislative session, which bills have to progress through, and by the way, leadership chooses how fast bills progress, well, it seems as though this, what we thought was an attempt to put together a bill, might not be as serious and well-intentioned as we, you know, charitably might have thought.
Imagine that, Dylan. Imagine that. Who would have guessed that? Oh, wait a minute. We guessed it. We called this out months ago.
The day that panel was announced to put together this legislation, you pretty much panned it as being a show. And this is what Joe's press conference this week was unfortunately about, is the fact that this legislation is being allowed to die in the committee process in the House right now.
Let's cut to a little bit of this, because Joe White really kind of went off on some of these guys. Let's take a look at some of what he had to say there at the Richland County Courthouse this week.
For over 2 years, the leadership of the General Assembly has known that we, the people, want judicial reform. Last year, the Speaker of the House, Sumter County Representative Merle Smith, formed an ad hoc committee to study that very issue. He appointed York County Representative Tommy Pope to head that ad hoc group. Representative Pope has repeatedly told me that he made it clear to Speaker Smith that he would do it only if there was a desire to come up with a serious reform bill. In February, with bipartisan leadership by Senator Clymer and Senator Harpootlian, Senate Bill 1046 was debated and eventually passed by the South Carolina Senate. After much delay, on February the 28th, House Bill H-5170 was read for the first time in the South Carolina House of Representatives. In its original form, S-1046 was a pretty good bill. It addressed almost every issue that we, the people, believe needs to change. What are those issues? Number one, the executive branch, the governor, must have the ability to appoint members to the JMSC. Number two, no trial lawyer who is also a legislator should be able to serve on the commission that qualifies potential judges. Number three, all candidates deemed qualified by the JMSC must have their names submitted to the General Assembly for consideration. And number four, the JMSC must become independent of the legislative branch. How excited I was when I read that original bill. But S-1046 in its final Senate version is a disaster. As approved by the Senate, the governor would have appointments, but those appointments are dictated by the legislature. As approved by the Senate, it would be possible for two-thirds of the people on the JMSC to be lawyer legislators, rather than the current 60%. As approved by the Senate, instead of the current limit of three potential candidates being sent to the General Assembly for a vote, the limit would increase to six, a slight improvement. S 1046 does make the JMSC independent of the legislative branch. It is possible to amend S 1046 to make it acceptable, but getting the House to do so and then getting the Senate to concur is a monumental task. Now I want to address the House judicial reform charade. That's correct, I said charade. I looked up that word to make sure it was the correct word. Here's the definition from the Oxford Dictionary. Charade, an absurd pretense intended to create a pleasant or respectable appearance. What makes H 5170 a charade? The process, the timing. At this point, it is not possible to have H 5170 debated, amended, and passed by the House before next Wednesday.
So, Dylan, obviously Representative White not happy with either the House process or the bill that came out of the Senate.
Yeah, and unfortunately, as he says in this press conference, that's about all, assuming that, you know, this House bill does not clear the procedural hurdles of needing to cross over to the Senate in time. The Senate bill, which is something that some friends of ours, you know, Senator Wes Clymer was certainly pushing this legislation. It was great when it started, and then to get it out of the Senate, there just had to be so much compromise with folks who are really don't have judicial reform as one of their actual interests that the bill is almost unrecognizable. So now the House leadership, folks who probably agree with those who watered down the Senate bill, get to say, well, if we deviate too much from this, then we're not going to get any reform, which means, you know, I'll be very interested to see what leadership chooses to do here. But they put their cards on the table in that they clearly don't want real reform. The question will be, do they, you know, let this die this legislative session and not pass any judicial reform, or do they try to rush through an extremely watered down piece of judicial reform and then say, look, we've passed judicial reform, put Alex Murdaugh in jail, passed judicial reform, everybody please go away, while we have a system that is in many ways that full of the same flaws as the one that has been provoking you to draw attention to it for the last decade.
Well, it's ultimately going to boil down to outcomes, Dylan. And I think one of the things that we've tried to do at Fitz News, in addition to following this legislative process to try to fix the system, but I think the real outcome-based accountability is holding these individual judges responsible, and particularly when it's a lawyer legislator in their court. And I like to think that so much attention has been drawn to this matter that it's a little harder today for a lawyer legislator to walk into a courtroom and throw their weight around and get these unjust outcomes on behalf of violent offenders. I think it's a little harder to do it now, but certainly that pressure is always still going to be there because they still control who the judges are. Nothing, none of these reforms did anything to fix that.
Yeah, that underlying pressure is always going to be there. And the way I look at it, if a system can be broken, which a system like this, obviously you're never going to have a perfect way of selecting judges. But if you have one that has such low-hanging fruit as far as possible unethical manipulation, I think you can count on somebody always taking advantage of that.
Yeah, water flows downstream, doesn't it?
Yes.
We talk about this bill effectively dead, not, you know, there's a pulse for potential meaningful reform. But on another front, another issue involving our justice system, our courts, a bill is completely dead. And when I'm talking about the liability reform bill, and again, for our audience who follows the Murdaugh saga, a big part of that, in fact, the impetus, according to many, for Alec Murdaugh's crimes, the civil case brought against him by attorney Mark Tinsley, the boat crash lawsuit, the liability case, there were a number of different people involved in that at different points. But now we're in a situation where lawmakers, we thought, had a deal to amend the way South Carolina's liability laws work. And for those of you who aren't familiar with them, in South Carolina, even if you're 1% culpable, responsible for a boating under the influence, driving under the influence incident, or a crime committed while someone's impaired, you can be held 100% liable under our current system. Lawmakers are trying to fix that. this week, Dylan, we thought there was an agreement in place, but it all went to hell pretty quickly, didn't it?
It did. And just to back up on what you just said, like, let's just think about how ridiculous this system is right now. Say you own Will's Bar. Somebody comes in, has a beer. So you've sold them a beer, right? They go, leave your bar, go home, have 12 more beers. And by the way, this guy's dead broke, and you're doing really well. You're a millionaire.
Thank you.
This guy gets in his car after drinking your one beer and a dozen of his own and goes and runs over a family. Well, the family's mad about this. They sue. Unfortunately, this guy has no money. You are partially responsible, though. You sold him that one beer. You're going to pay all of the money, even though you were only very, very, very small part responsible.
Yeah, that's the current South Carolina system, and it is driving insurance rates in the Palmetto State through the roof. In fact, we've had folks, Representative Jay Kilmartin at his business, has had to stop selling alcohol. He, in fact, turned his permit in. Our Andy Fancher did a big report on that, turned his permit in to the Department of Revenue saying, I can't afford to sell alcohol anymore.
Right. And unfortunately, Representative Jay Kilmartin, being a small business owner, being a guy who owns and operates restaurants, is vastly outnumbered by folks who are positively financially impacted by things like this down there at the State House. And that was something that we saw this week. Unfortunately, most of our state representatives aren't losing a dime to this because very, very many of them are attorneys. Very many of them are the plaintiff's attorneys whose fees come from winning cases like this. It's very upsetting because it's something that means that folks who might want to do business in South Carolina aren't going to be able to afford insurance to do so. And to be clear, none of us are saying here that if you participate in business activities which result in folks dying, that you shouldn't pay your fair share of that. But what we're saying is you should pay your fair share of that and not pay for what other people, you know, can't afford to pay if it's not really your fault. And that's what this law was attempting to do, was basically say, okay, if you're less than halfway liable, then we're going to go by what percentage of liability you have when we're assigning who has to pay up. Which, of course, seems very fair to you, seems very fair to me. This is what the state of Florida does. And it's very interesting because this change to the law would have applied across all domains, but at the Judiciary Committee level. And this is a guy who just keeps coming up. Luke Rankin, his Judiciary Committee in the Senate, submitted an amendment specifically to exempt alcohol-selling businesses from this more fair interpretation of liability law. So you can tell the Judiciary Committee, you know, which is a committee that's controlled by the trial attorney's lobby, basically. They pay a lot of money to get people that they control into those key seats, wanted this amendment. They fought it tooth and nail on the Senate floor this week. And eventually, you know, I got to tip my hat here to the Senate Republicans who voted this down. They voted to table that amendment. And I think that this was part of the discord that eventually led to the whole thing falling apart later in the week. But I'm still not clear on the underlying dynamics here in the Senate. Is it a kind of situation where proponents of this legislation think, okay, listen, we got elections coming up. We're going to be able to flip a couple of seats here to people who we know aren't in the tank for the trial attorneys. And we're going to be able to come back next time with more leverage and not have to make any concessions. So it's better to not have it right now. I think it might be a situation like that. So I don't want to come in here and go bam, bam on some of these people who voted to put this bill on the back burner right now, because I think some of them might be doing it with the best intentions of this reform at their hearts and in their minds. But what we do know is that there was certainly enough opposition to this in the Senate, and there was enough leverage against it in the Senate that it was clear that they weren't going to be able to reach a compromise and get this reform done, which means that, you know, until they can get this done, we're going to continue to see unfair settlements in our civil courts, which is going to make South Carolina a worse place to do business than many of the states which are around us.
Well, and I hate to say it, Dylan, but also those mom and pop businesses, a lot of them are going to continue to go under until we get that reform passed, the jobs they create, the incomes they provide, the prosperity they contribute to. But something you said that's interesting, you talked about potentially framing this debate in a future session after the 2024 elections, possibly having a Republican majority or supermajority that didn't have to kowtow to some of these trial lawyer demands. It's interesting you said that because Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey is the one that pulled this off the calendar, that basically said, hey, we're done. We're not going to pass a worthwhile compromise now. We're going to come back later. That kind of points to your theory having some possible merit there, Dylan.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to come back later with some more of my friends kind of thing, which is why, you know, I don't want to bash Shane for pulling this off the calendar, because I think he's doing it with the best interests of the legislation at heart. But it does really stink for those small business owners who, until they are going to be able to get something across the finish line here, are going to have to deal with these increased costs and potentially just have to close up shop.
Well, speaking of Senate elections, it's a nice segue into another item we wanted to discuss as we covered the state house.
By the way,
this
is a race between an attorney and a non-attorney. Yeah. So, you know, do the calculus on how this will affect these issues.
That's right. It's a Republican primary race. You've been covering it. Incumbent State Senator Sandy Sinn. She is an attorney out of the Charleston area. She is one of the five sister senators who were responsible for standing up to one of the stringent anti-abortion laws that was passed earlier this year. That was actually initially passed 2 years ago. Taking a lot of heat for that. A lot of those Republican sister senators have taken a lot of heat for their position favoring more lenient restrictions on abortion.
I believe that she was in favor of one trimester.
Correct. First trimester. It ended up being a 6 week.
So she was well in it, you know, allowing abortions much longer than the Republican supermajority ended up putting into law.
And her opponent, State Representative Matt Lieber, has seized on that issue and made it a defining issue in his campaign. But this week, Dylan, we got a video drop, and let's just play this from Senator Sandy Sinn's campaign. This is, I guess, a campaign commercial dropped by her campaign. Let's take a look.
As an elected state rep, I will always advocate for a pro-life agenda.
And when you look at me, I want you to hear my life, pro-life story.
She was too young. She was ruining her life. Her mother, which is my daughter, said that her first grandchild needs to be aborted.
In the end, I'm winning, you lost, because you just missed out on so much.
All right, Dylan, you've been dealing with both of these campaigns, both of these candidates. What the heck is going on here with this allegation?
Well, we should mention that this isn't the first set of allegations that Senator Sinn has dropped. She also had her political team there comb through all of Lieber's history. He had a pretty contentious family court case, so that they were able to pull a lot of stuff from a couple of other incidents. Now, I don't know how many folks put a lot of weight into that, but this, I think, is more important because it talks about the central policy issue. So no longer can somebody say, oh, well, you know, personal life of politicians, I don't really care. I think in this day and age, with all of our politicians being so morally questionable, those types of hits might not land as they would have a couple of decades ago. But this is central to the issue. But something that I keep hearing from Lieber's campaign team that I think they're really hoping people connect with is those two individuals didn't have their names in the video.
That's
they didn't
true.
Have their faces in the video. So also these true. Accusations, if you're Lieber, are really hard to rebut, because what do you even say?
Right. And obviously they declined to comment on the record regarding the allegations, and I can't blame them for that. I mean, certainly an anonymous allegation like that. But the interesting thing, we're told several of Lieber's family members will be addressing this. Apparently there's an interview perhaps with the Post and Courier. Certainly, we would invite Representative Lieber to come on our show anytime and address these allegations, which, again, you got to wonder if Senator Sandy Sinn puts them out there in this very public forum.
And I think it's really interesting that there's no names and faces, because this is her campaign's being run, at least in part, by Wesley Donahue, the knife fighter. We've had him on our set before. And Wesley has a great podcast of his own that I really enjoy. I just found it recently, but I've really been enjoying listening to the episodes. And I was driving down to the Lowcountry for a story, listening to one of these episodes, and he talks about with one of his guests the strategy of putting out a piece of information that you know that the opposing campaign's going to deny. And then once they're on the record denying it, you release another piece of information that you, of course, had waiting in the wings the whole time that, oh, yeah, this is true. And it's very interesting because the folks over at Team Lieber have not actually denied this. They've just not commented. So they don't want to get caught there with their chin out and say, oh, this isn't XYZ. And then Senator Sen comes back with the haymaker of, oh, yeah, well, we have proof that it is what you're saying it isn't. Because that's the real 1-2 combo punch that every political operative is looking for in a situation like this.
Well, it is. But also, don't forget, if Lieber can turn this around on Sandy Sen, and I think he's done a fairly capable job of pushing back against some of her first round of attacks. Obviously, you dug deep into them and found that not everything Senator Sen...
Some of it was stuff that just didn't look good. I mean, there's no, you know, there was a temporary protective order granted against Lieber. Now, this is something where he wasn't allowed to show up in court, and he didn't even know that this proceeding was happening. There was very little evidence presented. But at the same time, one could factually say a domestic violence protective order was granted against Lieber. Now, was this order rescinded once, you know, he was able to come in and tell his side of the story? Yes. But it's never going to look good. The same thing did not go for all of the other allegations, though. Like, one thing that Sen was blasting on her website was this dispute with a woman in Georgia who doesn't say this on her website, but this woman was a tenant of Lieber's who completely destroyed one of his properties, did $60,000 in damages, for which she has both criminal and civil
liabilities. Sounds like my kids every weekend, man.
Yes, just like your children trashing the house. But this, they take one piece of this dispute and completely mischaracterize the whole thing. They make it sound like Lieber's stalking this woman. No, this woman's a tenant of his.
Conflate it, yeah.
Right, who didn't pay him. Like, it's just not what the situation was. So this could easily, and of course, when I write about this, doesn't look great for Team Sen, because once you have all the, full set of facts in front of you, you're like, okay, are they just manipulating everything to make it look worse than it is?
You've been cussed out by both of these campaigns and covering
this.
Well,
yeah, that's how I knew I did well on my first article, was within half an hour of publication, both principals are calling me, like, upset with details and the coverage. But I was just trying to be factual about what I was finding looking at these allegations. So yeah. I tried to get to the bottom of it. And the interesting thing is we're not to the bottom of this abortion video. I would like to, confirm or deny these allegations, but I don't have the requisite information in front of me right now to be able to do that.
Well, right now we're going to go ahead and challenge both of these candidates, not only to come on the air to address these issues, but we'll actually host a debate between the two of y'all for this seat. It's a very important race. In fact, we'll throw that out there for all these races. This is a Republican primary, but we've got very close Senate races that we're looking at. District 39, that could be a very close general election. District 35 over there, Sumter, that could be a very close general election. So we've got, for the first time in a while, some potentially competitive races, not only in the Republican primary, which is where most of these races are decided in South Carolina, but also a few general election races. So maybe Senator Massey's calculus about a new supermajority in the Senate was the way to go, Dylan.
Yeah, and like you were just saying, I think we're here to help expose the truth when we can, but also for these candidates, we're not going to have time to dig into all of these races on our own. Our open microphone policy is definitely open to candidates and those who might want to speak on behalf of a candidate. So if they'd like to send a submission in, we would be happy to run that. And I think you were busy this week putting together some guidelines so that folks might even have a better idea what we're looking for and something like that.
Absolutely. And for those of you new to Fitz News, the open microphone is always on, always open, whether or not it is critical of what we say. I mean, heck, that's what we're here for. I mean, it's a free forum. It's a open marketplace. I always say one of two things is going to happen when you let somebody criticize you. You're either going to become smarter or they're going to look like an idiot. So, hey, we'll take it either way. But Dylan, great job reporting over at the State House this week on a number of different issues. Appreciate your attention to detail, not only on these intricate legislative matters, but also these very sensitive campaign allegations. Just doing great work on multiple fronts. Dylan Nolan, everybody, our Director of Special Projects, and our newest political reporter extraordinaire.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's a wrap for this week's edition. I want to thank everybody for joining us this week. Also want to thank everyone for joining us last week on that first ever Month in Review, a live show, which I was incredibly excited with how that turned out. and excited about the future of that program. So be on the lookout over the course of the next few weeks for updates as we prepare our next month in review. But for now, thanks again for tuning in, and we will catch you next time on the Week in Review.